This week on The Score, advocates discuss proposed election law reforms. A historian relates the long story of Jewish citizens in Charlottesville. Political scientists look back at JFK and LBJ. Ringing in the festive season with Ernest Hemingway's favorite cocktails. All this and more coming up on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere, and I hope you've recovered from a tasty Thanksgiving. This week's episode is a pretty even mix of recent interviews and older conversations drawn from The Score's archives. This year's congressional elections brought the frustrations of seemingly endless ballot counts and recounts, ridiculously close races that were not determined for weeks, and allegations about both voter suppression and election fraud. Meanwhile, there are organizations taking a serious, sustained look at potential election law reforms, such as changing campaign finance regulations, revising the way lawmakers draw legislative districts, and ranked choice voting, also known as instant runoff, which for the first time this year determined the outcome in a congressional election in Maine, as it happens. Last Sunday in Charlottesville, the local League of Women Voters hosted a panel discussion with two advocates of these and other changes in the way Americans vote. After the forum closed, I asked both speakers about the issues that concern them and the solutions they see for problems. First, University of Virginia economist Sally Hudson, who represents Fair Vote Virginia, answered my questions about ranked choice voting, or RCV. First question, what's the impetus for election law reform? Why are people interested in it these days?
I mean, I think a lot of people are seeing some brokenness in our politics on full display, that our politics has become so divided, and so they're looking for concrete policy reforms that can encourage both more diverse voices to enter the process, but also a politics that doesn't penalize us for recognizing what we have in common, because we really have gotten to a with us or against us space, and so it means that lots of issues that have broad-based support from the electorate aren't getting the time of day in the halls of power.
One of the things you were talking about is ranked choice voting, and it's a topic that's interested me for a long time. What are the advantages of ranked choice voting?
What ranked choice voting does is allow every voter to go to the ballot box and say how they really feel about the candidates. So you can say, this is my first choice, this is my second choice, and if I can't have those, here's my backup. And that has a virtuous cycle for democracy because it means that voters get to say how they really want, and politicians have to speak to what really matters to voters. So you tend to see more voter engagement, higher turnout, and more candidates entering the race, which ultimately means we have more choices.
What do you think would be the effect, in Virginia in particular, on ranked choice voting in the historic phenomenon of mostly uncontested races for the General Assembly? 2017 was an outlier. There were a lot of contested races.
Yeah.
That's historically an anomaly. Or in a place like Charlottesville, which is essentially a one-party democracy. People just don't run for city council unless they're Democrats. What does ranked choice voting do to encourage competition in places where it does not exist?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think you would see more contested races and with higher turnout. That's what we've tended to see in places that have adopted ranked choice in the past.
Ranked choice voting, or we should say for our listeners, this is also known as instant runoff. How does it interact with things like redistricting reform, combating gerrymandering?
So I tend to think that ranked choice voting and fair districting are mutually supportive issues, and that what ranked choice voting does is eliminate some of the temptation to gerrymander, because gerrymandering is all about drawing the right lines around people who fall in either the blue box or the red box, and since ranked choice voting allows us to be more diverse than that and to say, you know, we're a broader political spectrum. It eliminates the incentive to put people in those boxes and then try to draw lines around them.
I want to bring up a couple of topics that were not discussed in the forum we just had, but it's relevant. It's recently been discussed, including in the New York Times, about increasing the numbers of members of Congress, because that has not changed since 1912, 435 members. It doesn't reflect growth in population. What do you think about a proposal like that?
So I should say that the Fair Vote Virginia is a single-issue organization, so the only thing on our docket is advocating for ranked choice voting. I think it is interesting that in the United States we have something like 700 to 800 thousand constituents per representative. Does that sound about right?
That's about right.
Whereas in other democracies that we would like to think of as our peers, that number is you know, eight times less than that. It's something more like 100 or 150 thousand. So we're asking individual representatives to represent incredibly diverse sets of people, and we shouldn't be surprised that in that setting maybe some voices don't get heard as loud as others.
And of course, there's a wide variation in state legislatures. In Virginia, you know, state senate. District, you know, 40 state senators, they're representing about 300,000 people. You go to New Hampshire, and a member of their House of Representatives represents about 2,000 people.
Right.
So you can literally knock on the door of every person you represent.
Absolutely.
Another topic would be multi-member districts. How would this be affected? You know, for example, let's say Virginia had 40 Senate districts, but within each of those Senate districts there were three House members. Would RCV affect that, or is it a separate issue?
So if you're interested in multi-member districts, you should look at the Fair Vote National Organization, which has worked with Congress to help draft the Fair Representation Act, which would bring multi-member districts and ranked choice voting to Congress. Don Beyer, who's a member of Virginia's congressional delegation, has led the charge on that. So there are definitely people thinking about how those two issues come together. Well, at Fair Vote Virginia, we're solely focused on the state and local level, but there's definitely a lot of people who would like to see those ideas unite.
You talked about a bill that would give a local option for ranked choice voting. So that a city like Charlottesville, a county like Albemarle could choose to do it. What about a bill to create a pilot program where a city like Charlottesville could say, hey, let's experiment with it and see how it works in the rest of the state? Is that an option in the legislative agenda right now?
So there are two separate kinds of bills that can go through the legislature. One is the local option, which says that any city or county could exercise the opportunity to do ranked choice. We can also have locality-specific bills, which would say, we here in Charlottesville would like to do this. Delegate Patrick Hope up in Arlington has submitted one of those on behalf of Arlington County. So those are the two different routes to ranked choice in Virginia.
But specifically in terms of a pilot program, like there have been, it's been discussed to have a pilot program for central voting precincts. You know, for like a low turnout primary where you don't have to open up all nine precincts, just have one.
In this particular case, where the legal barrier is just the right to do it. In other words, you should think of the local option and the pilot program as kind of the same bill.
Okay.
Because Charlottesville, I believe, is one of the localities that already has ranked choice capable hardware. So it's not like we need the pilot program to buy the machines.
Right. I was on the electoral board when we bought those machines.
Right.
And that was one of the things we were looking at.
Yeah.
And Hart InterCivic, which is a company that makes the machines that Charlottesville uses, I think Alexandria and Falls Church.
Yeah.
That was one of their big advertising pushes. You know, they said, this is what you can do with it.
Right.
I guess the final question I have is, where do we go legislatively? Who's supporting these bills in the General Assembly? Mm-hmm. Who should we talk to? And what do we need to do to get it past the committee level and onto a floor vote?
Great. So on the House side, the chief patrons have been Nick Freitas in Culpeper, and then also Patrick Hope up in Arlington. On the Senate side, Senator Adam Eben has signed on. We're still working on a Republican patron, but we have several folks who are interested, and we're optimistic that we'll get all four of those nailed down before the start of the session. Right now, the most important thing that people can be doing is continuing to spread the story of ranked choice voting, because it's at that stage where it's on people's radar, and if folks can talk to people about what's happened in Maine and in all the successful municipal pilots around the country, that really starts to build steam. So, you know, folks can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter or visit our website at fairvoteva.org to learn more, and then pass that on to your friends.
Yeah, one of the things I've said about ranked choice voting over the years is it takes longer to explain it than to do it.
Absolutely.
But thanks for your time today.
Happy holidays from The Score with Rick Sincere.
Sharing the podium with Hudson was newly minted law school graduate Brian Snow, representing the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. I was a bit more combative with him than I am with other interview subjects, as you'll see.
What's the main impetus for election reform, and what are some of the issues that you're advocating?
The main impetus, I think, is the growing recognition in recent decades, and especially recent years, that the policy that is being made is further and further from representing the interest of the many. I think that's really the impetus, and this is an impetus on both the left and the right. It's a really kind of a stunning level of realization that policy has shifted so far towards the interests of the few. And I think there's, as we talked about today, there's a number of different areas of reform that could help bring the focus back on the individual voters and the many.
Among the topics that were discussed today were campaign finance reform, redistricting reform, ranked choice voting. If you were to set the priorities, if you were Speaker of the House, which order would you take those in?
I honestly wouldn't. I don't think there's a need to rank them. I think we're at a very important. If you want to talk about gerrymandering reform, as we touched on, we're at a very crucial point because the maps are going to be redrawn after the 2020 census. So this is kind of our last chance for 10 years to do that. So in that sense, gerrymandering reform, we can pass any of these bills any other time. But that's the big, and that's why there's one Virginia 2021 is pushing on this heavily because this is their chance to do that. But I think I would put all of these reforms under the category of good government, more representative government. And I think that they all really belong in the same conversation for that reason.
Do you think these types of reforms will help the widespread phenomenon of uncontested races? I mean, if you look back at 2017, there were a lot of races in the Virginia General Assembly that were contested for the first time in 10, 15 years. Historically, most seats go uncontested. Mm-hmm. Would these reforms help to find competitors against incumbents in most of these seats?
Absolutely. Each one of these reforms would do that in different ways. So certainly if you're having districts that are less heavily gerrymandered, they're more competitive year to year, and certainly that encourages more competition. As far as ranked choice voting, you might have even in a gerrymandered district or just a district that's naturally gerrymandered and it might be a more red or blue area, you're going to have more competition within the parties without that party risking losing the general election because they're splitting their vote. If you have a ranked choice system, you have much more, it's much more of a marketplace of ideas. And I think that's certainly clear. And then for campaign finance, absolutely, especially when you're talking about something like public financing, because the barriers to entry are so high for candidates to raise money that incumbents have a huge advantage doing that because they're already there, and the people who their policy is affecting, the big money players, are already there talking to them. So all three of those really have their own role to play in that.
In terms of campaign finance legislation, would you support limits on spending or just limits on contributions?
So, again, because of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence around the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which, of course, because of the Supremacy Clause controls the states. And all the way through Citizens United speech now. There's little that can be done to simply regulate the amount of, the total gross amount of money spent by campaigns. Obviously, you can regulate certain kinds of spending, like I touched on. Right now, Virginia doesn't prevent personal use of campaign funds, which is just kind of outrageous, and I think it should be shocking and surprising to everyone. So that's certainly a way that you could regulate how the money is spent. But in terms of gross limits, you're not going to get that outside of a public financing regime, which, again, make public financing contingent upon agreeing to abide by limits, which would never happen in Virginia, almost never happen in Virginia, because there's no limits to the amount of the money that can be raised and spent. It would be hard for a candidate to be competitive for doing that.
One of the public financing options that you brought up was something I never heard of before, the democracy voucher, mm-hmm. in which everybody would get a check for $100 that they could give to any candidate.
Yeah.
Most of those would go unused. Mm-hmm. Does that just go back into the Treasury?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And the jurisdictions that have passed these have some experience in terms of figuring out how much is going to be used. And they're usually one of the complicated parts is the funding side, because you need to make sure it's fully funded. You can't incentivize people to do it first and then they run out.
Right.
And then also you don't know exactly how much it's going to be. So it's certainly an investment in democracy. But I think that, to me, that's what gets me most excited about this, because there are areas in their communities where people simply don't have a dollar to give, mm-hmm. and these are often the people in communities that are most affected by policy. So this gives them a voice, and it, especially as I said in the talk, it creates really strong candidate incentives to go to those communities and go to those individuals and earn their vote, and also earn their democracy voucher, to earn their money.
What would prevent a third party, like a lobbyist, just going door to door, knocking and collecting these vouchers and then turning into a campaign?
There are mechanisms that prevent third parties from casting or from like donating the vouchers directly. So it's not like a piece of paper that has a code or something and you can give it up. But I don't know that there'd be a way to prevent people from, you know.
It's essentially bundling.
Yeah, right. I don't know that there's a good way to prevent that from happening, except that you know, just like you do with like absentee ballots or whatnot, you make people sign a form that says, I was not given anything of value to cast my vote, except, say, a policy promise. I promise to extend Medicare. So, you know,
right. Well, that would be illegal anyway. You can't give money to a candidate in return for a promise to vote in a particular
issue. Promise to vote, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's already illegal.
Right.
You mentioned Citizens United, corporate contributions and such. Do you think a corporation like the Washington Post should be prohibited from endorsing candidates?
No, I think that the news media holds a special place in our society.
News media corporations
are different from for-profit.
They have a privilege that the rest of us don't have.
That the rest of us don't have?
Right. I mean, I'm not a major corporation, but I have a right to speak out about candidates or give money to candidates.
Mm-hmm.
But you're saying that the restrictions on campaign contributions would not apply to media corporations.
No, I mean, I suppose you could treat it as an in-kind contribution, but I'm not actually taking a position on corporate campaign expenditure. Yeah.
So you don't think that the government has a right to restrict how and whether we can talk about politics?
I certainly do. I certainly think that there are compelling government interests that, when narrowly tailored, can be sufficient to justify restrictions on speech and on a whole host of things.
You think that the government can prohibit people from saying, I support candidate A or say candidate Y?
No, but you asked the question whether the Constitution should tolerate any kind of limits, and I'm saying certainly there are compelling government interests that would be sufficient to justify a narrowly tailored law.
That would restrict how we can talk about politics.
Well, like I said, I mean, if you're talking about corporations, I certainly think that there are laws that could be, that there are interests strong enough, governmental interests strong enough, that could justify a narrowly tailored law that would limit certain kinds of speech. I wouldn't say you personally, but I would certainly say, you know, that's my personal belief. But
some people should be prohibited from talking about politics while others are not.
I would say corporate persons, being that they don't have the same skin in the game that natural persons do, I would say certainly that would be a distinction.
But aren't corporations just groups of individuals drawn together for a common purpose?
Well, there's different kinds of corporations. I mean, the tax code's full of different kinds of corporations.
Like NAREL. Or the
NRA.
League of Women Voters.
Yeah, or NRA.
The League
NRA,
of Women
yeah.
Voters is a corporation.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
But
so is Exxon.
Yeah, so should they both be treated the same?
I would say a nonprofit corporation should be treated differently from a for-profit corporation.
Citizens United was a nonprofit corporation.
Sure, yeah. I think there's a great argument that Citizens United should have won that case, but it shouldn't have been extended as far as it went.
Well, I don't want to go too much farther on this. I want to talk to your colleague.
Sure.
But Ryan Snow, thank you for coming to talk about campaign finance reform and election law reform. It was a really good conversation.
And thank you for your tough questions.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BearingDrift.com.
On the same general topic of election reform, 3 years ago at the Virginia Festival of the Book, I spoke with Jason Grumet, president of the Bipartisan Policy Center, about his book called City of Rivals. My conversation with Grumet comes from the archives.
Let's start by having you introduce yourself. What's your name and where do you work and what's the name of your book?
So I'm Jason Grumet. I'm the president of the Bipartisan Policy Center. My book is called City of Rivals, Restoring the Glorious Mess of American Democracy.
Good title. Tell me about the Bipartisan Policy Center.
So I founded the Bipartisan Policy Center about 8 years ago with the help of four former Senate majority leaders, Tom Daschle, Bob Dole, George Mitchell, and Howard Baker. And we now have about 90 staff who are committed to the art of principled compromise and constructive collision of good ideas. We don't believe in nonpartisanship. We want people who are proud, aggressive partisans who are willing to substantiate their views and negotiate.
In your remarks earlier, you talked about media, money,
and mandering
of the
Jerry nature.
Tell me about those three things. What are they doing to bipartisanship in Washington?
So, you know, all three are, you know, significant issues in our democracy. My point is that they do not lend themselves towards solutions. So the somewhat myopic focus on the three of those as the reform agenda is going to make people frustrated. We've always had money in politics. We have more now. It's more transparent now. It could be more transparent still. But we have a Supreme Court that has made pretty clear that we're not going to be moving money out of politics anytime soon. And so I think a better agenda would be to try to force all donations to be disclosed. The media has always been confrontational. It's different now. It's disaggregated now. But it's not a new concept that media seeks out the conflict in stories. But again, the larger issue is the media gives us what we ask for, and there's no act in a nation with free speech that's going to change that. So it's a howling at the moon problem. Gerrymandering is a concern. It is undermining to the democracy to have the politicians choosing the voters as opposed to the voters choosing the politicians. It just doesn't matter as much as a lot of people think. The high watermark for redistricting reform would be the tenor of the U.S. Senate. There are no districts in the Senate. It is not exactly a venue of great collaboration. We have essentially sorted ourselves so that no matter how you draw districts, we are still going to have a diminishing number of competitive primaries. So I believe we need to make efforts to create bipartisan redistricting commissions and get away from some of these crazy gerrymandered districts. But in and of itself, it is not going to be the solution to the fractious nature of our democracy.
The Supreme Court right now is considering a case regarding a redistricting commission in Arizona. Do you know anything about that case and what the outcome might be?
Well, if I could tell you the outcome of that case, I could also tell you the price of oil in a month. An interesting question, because the essence of it, as I understand it, is that the legislature was basically taken out of the redesign process. It's an independent commission, and there is a question about whether, in fact, it is constitutional to have redistricting happen without legislative prerogative. It doesn't mean that you couldn't have redistricting commissions that require there to be three Democrats and three Republicans. I mean, you could do a lot. It wouldn't eliminate the capacity to seek better efforts when it comes to redrawing lines, but it could limit a certain type of redistricting commission.
Ethics reform has been a big issue in Virginia this year, and you talked a bit about that in terms of ethics issues in Washington. Can you just illustrate some of the problems with ethics rules?
Well, so the issue is simply that they're not perfect. They are over-aggressive in certain areas in ways that I think make people feel better but don't accomplish much, and they miss aspects of the problem in other regards. And so I think the issue is really just to focus them more effectively.
So one last question. Yesterday the president broached the idea of compulsory voting. How would that fit into your program, if at all?
Well, again, I think there is a constitutional issue. It's more of an aspiration than a practical solution. Like everything, there are pros and cons. Obviously, it would be terrific to have greater participation in a participatory democracy. In Australia, they find, though, the downside is a lot of people are essentially forced to vote who have no desire to participate in the process, no information about the process, and so there's a question about whether you dilute the quality of the voter pool. Having 20% participate is no good. Having 100% participate probably also has some problems. 60-70% would be great.
Well, thanks for your time today.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BearingDrift.com.
When The Score returns, we'll hear from historian Phyllis Loeffler about the Jews of Charlottesville from the early 19th century to the present. Larry Sabato talks about John F. Kennedy, and Robert Mann looks at the 1964 presidential election. The Score will be right back, and so will you.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
When Nazis marched on Charlottesville in August 2017, they chanted, "Jews will not replace us," and "Into the ovens." members of the city's Jewish community, which has roots going back to the days of Thomas Jefferson, were understandably distraught and frightened. At a lecture sponsored by the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society earlier in November, historian Phyllis Leffler outlined the story of Charlottesville's Jews over the centuries. After the discussion ended, I asked her a few questions about Jewish history in Virginia.
When was the first synagogue established in Virginia and later the first one in Charlottesville?
I can't tell you when the exact first one was in Richmond, but I think it was in 1789 in Richmond, so I think that may well have been the first in Virginia. In 1789, in Charlottesville, the synagogue was erected in 1882.
So almost 100 years later. From your talk tonight, and I'm talking with Dr. Phyllis Leffler, a historian, a member of the board of the Albemarle Charlottesville Historical Society, which is being reinvigorated. From your talk tonight, you indicated that there have been ebbs and flows of acceptance and alienation of the Jewish community in Charlottesville. Can you kind of outline that? It appears that the early part of the 19th century shifted to the later part of the 19th century.
Yeah. First of all, during the colonial period, we know so little really about how many Jews there were here and what they did. So I think there was too small a number to really be able to make many generalizations. But the first Jewish family started arriving in the 1840s, and they were incredibly successful and prosperous merchants. As far as I can see, there was essentially no anti-Semitism, no discrimination, no prejudice, because they were absolute pillars of the community. So I would say that what went from about the 1840s to at least the 1890s. That was one period that was very positive in terms of the Jewish experience. Starting in the 1890s, you begin to have a national shift in attitudes as more immigrants begin to come to this country, particularly from Eastern Europe, and racial typologies begin to develop. Jews are thought of as not being white, and there is growing anti-Semitism, growing nativism within America. And so from about the 1890s to at least the 1930s or 40s, there is much more anti-Semitism nationwide, which also affects Charlottesville, and it affects Charlottesville also in terms of exclusions from country clubs like Farmington, housing covenants that denied housing in certain areas to Jews. The Klan is active during that period, which targets Jews, among other people. So that's a pretty virulent anti-Semitic time in American history. Charlottesville's Jews were subject to that same virulence. Then from after World War II, when anti-Semitism is discredited because of the Nazi era, things begin to get better, and there is more opportunity for Jews, more opportunity at universities, etc. But it gets complicated for Jews because of the civil rights movement and how Jews are actually going to respond when they're not necessarily really thought of as fully white and full members of the society. So that's another period that you have to sort of think about, how the anti-Semitism fits in to this whole period and where Jews fit in the civil rights struggle.
As you were talking about the period of the 1920s and 30s, for some reason it just sparked in my mind a memory of Alfred Urey's play Last Night at Ballyhoo, which is set in Atlanta, but it's about Southern Jews and mostly of German descent and how they have assimilated, and then the coming of Eastern European Jews. Did the Charlottesville Jewish community experience any of that division as newer immigrants came in the 20th century and tried to fit in with the older immigrants from the 19th century?
That is a really fascinating question, and it's a conflict, of course, that is a part of the Jewish experience in America. So as far as we can tell from the evidence that we have, there was generally good relationships that were maintained between those two groups. The Eastern European Jews tended to be more traditional in their style of observance, and so there were some conflicts about worship style and things like that, but there was a lot of cooperation in which the Jews of the Jews who had been here for a longer period of time, mostly of German descent, offered other alternatives for prayer spaces and, you know, helped accommodate these communities. I think, in part, Charlottesville was too small of a Jewish community for those divisions to really grow. It's amazing to me that there has only been one synagogue in this town for its entire history.
That is hard to believe.
And I actually published a little brochure tied to a museum exhibit from the 1990s about the Jewish experience in Charlottesville, and I called it, or we called it, the group that did it, to seek the peace of the city. And I think Jews did that. I think they tried to integrate themselves into the life of the city, and they sought to be peaceful with one another as a way for the community to flourish and grow.
You mentioned one family in particular that has national prominence, the Levy family. Uriah Levy is said to be the man who saved Monticello. Can you comment just a bit on his family and their relationship to Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Jefferson's home up on the Little Mountain?
Well, Uriah P. Levy was a big fan of Jefferson. He was a, believed that his own opportunity within the Navy had to do with Jefferson's views on religious toleration. And so Jefferson had always been something of a hero to him. He had something of a difficult personality and had some problems in his experience in the Navy. But
He experienced anti-Semitism in the Navy, didn't he?
He did experience some, but he also was a pretty difficult character in his own right, so it's a little hard to exactly know what the motivation was. But when he had the opportunity, he purchased Monticello just 2 years after Jefferson died with the intent of preserving it. And then when he died in 1852, he offered the property to the United States government, and there were problems with the ensuing Civil War, etc., and nothing really happened. And then this nephew of his, interestingly named Jefferson Monroe Levy, which tells you something about the family's values, was able to take over Monticello. And there were, I think, some deep conflicts within the family over who would actually be able to buy the property. But Jefferson Monroe Levy did. And then he never married. So, but he did, he was a very, very good local citizen when he was here in terms of promoting the civic life of Charlottesville.
And he was a steward of a national, well, indeed, UNESCO assigned international treasure.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you for your comments tonight. I really enjoyed learning what I learned because there was a lot of stuff here I'd never heard before. So I really appreciate it. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Happy Holidays from the Score with Rick Sincere.
This past week marked the 55th anniversary of the murder of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. If you haven't yet heard the Score's special episode about November 22, 1963, be sure to visit the Bering Drift website to listen. 5 years ago, in the weeks leading up to the 50th anniversary of the assassination, the UVA Center for Politics hosted an event launching a new book, The Kennedy Half Century. I spoke to the author, Larry Sabato, about JFK's politics and what would have been his prospects for re-election.
Larry Sabato, tell me about your book, The Kennedy Half Century.
This has been a five-year project. I've undertaken it because I knew the 50th anniversary was coming up. And even though we've talked only about the assassination, two-thirds of the book is about President Kennedy's life, presidency, and then his legacy through nine successors. Legacy is a kind of life after death. And Kennedy's words and deeds were so powerful that his successors of both parties have used him to accomplish their own agendas, and some of them very cleverly. The best was Reagan. He used Kennedy even better than Lyndon Johnson did. Johnson distorted the Kennedy legacy, certainly by the middle of his second of his full term. But on the whole, I want to focus more on President Kennedy's life than on his death. I think all of us would want that. But you can't understand the legacy until you understand the assassination, because it created so much of the Kennedy myth.
Yeah, well, there are some historians who argue that Kennedy would never be rated in the top 10 presidents if he had lived.
Oh, that's absolutely true, and I've got a great anecdote for you that I put in the book, because I was stunned when I came across it. President Kennedy invited an historian of the Lincoln period to the White House, and he gave an interesting lecture, and the president asked the first question. He said, "Tell me, do you think that Lincoln would be as highly regarded had he not been assassinated?" And the historian immediately answered, "Well, of course not, because he would have had to deal with the nitty-gritty of Reconstruction. He wouldn't have had the martyrdom conferred by assassination and several other reasons." And Kennedy said, "Exactly what I thought." And apparently he made a comment to Jackie later on, "Well, if I'm going to die, this would be a good time." Now, that was shortly after the Cuban Missile Crisis. But the same principle applies to Kennedy. Had he actually faced the challenges of the 60s, had he lived through two full terms, for one thing, his marital infidelity could have come out. I mean, there were so many women. It's amazing that it didn't come out during his short presidency. All kinds of things could have happened. But I don't think he would be nearly as highly regarded. And, you know, presidencies tend to deteriorate in the last two or three years of an eight-year term. Well, he never had to face that. And he died at a peak moment of American power, economically and militarily.
One could certainly make the argument that Lyndon Johnson or Kennedy would not have been able to push through civil rights legislation the way Johnson did.
True.
On Kennedy's shoulders.
Absolutely. Well, I think after the 64 election, he would have beaten Goldwater. Goldwater would have still been the nominee. He would have beaten him 55-45 instead of 61-38. The difference is that Kennedy was much more cautious than Johnson by nature. He would have stopped at the Civil Rights Act. I don't think he really would have pushed for the Voting Rights Act or the Open Housing Act, unless he were forced to. But that's what came across to me. The more I read about Kennedy, the more I talked to the people who are still living from his administration, just how cautious he was. He was fiscally cautious. The only reason why he was worried about his across-the-board tax cut was because it would increase the deficit. He was a budget hawk in a lot of ways. Foreign policy, my God, look at the rhetoric. That's why Reagan adopted Kennedy, because he could adapt that rhetoric to his fight against the evil empire. So, this was a very different kind of Democrat. People have forgotten it. They've mixed him up with Bobby in the later years and then Teddy's career. But Jack Kennedy was the moderate or moderate conservative in the family.
And if you look at the 1960 campaign, Kennedy was accusing the Eisenhower administration of being soft on the Soviets.
Absolutely. Yeah, the missile gap,
right,
which was totally non-existent,
right, exactly,
which he later admitted after the election. But he was the hawk.
Well, I've got here, let's switch gears to Virginia politics. Put on your Virginia politics hat. What do you think is going to happen in the next 2 weeks leading up to the election? Can Cuccinelli catch up to McCaulin?
Well, anything's theoretically possible. I think it's highly unlikely. Something gigantic would have to happen in the final debate, October 24th. That's really the only big event remaining. I think that the trends are pretty strongly in the Democrats' favor, not because people are in love with McAuliffe, but simply because he was lucky enough to be the Democratic nominee opposing this ticket. I mean, this ticket is pretty far to the right.
And nobody
too
else
far
wanted
from Virginia.
To run for
nobody.
Governor.
Nobody. Well, one reason they didn't was because they thought Cuccinelli would win. We had this long trend of voting for the party opposite the president, and Cuccinelli had won in a landslide for attorney general, and I think a lot of Democrats said, I don't want to do it.
I've noticed over the past couple days that a lot of people in Cuccinelli's camp are suddenly going after Robert Sarbanes.
Yeah.
Attacking him on social media.
They are.
Why would they be doing that when McAuliffe is the primary opponent?
Because they believe incorrectly that Sarbanes's 8 to 12%, whatever it is, all right, let's say 10 for the purpose of argument, that somehow if Sarbanes were to be convinced to drop out, why, that 10% would move to Cuccinelli. A total misreading of the data. In fact, you can break it down. Cuccinelli would probably pick up net about 2 points, but you also have McAuliffe voters there, and you have people who would not vote or would write in a candidate if they didn't have someone else to vote for. So it's a misreading of the election data, and they're grasping at straws because, let's face it, they've got a steep uphill climb.
Although it's doubtful now that Sarvis will be able to reach that 10% threshold, if he does, what does that mean for Virginia becoming a state with three ballot status parties as opposed to just two?
Well, you know, for a whole election cycle, you get automatic placement on the ballot and a lot more respect. I understand because I've been in the position of running in debates, but when I turned down a third-party candidate, it was because he was nowhere near the 10% level. Sarvis has been over the 10% level in a number of surveys, and they all have a margin of error. I think he's at 9 or something like that in the polling averages. I got news for you. You know, there's a 2 or 3% margin of error, and that suggests that he could just as easily be over 10 as under 10. I'm surprised that there hasn't been more of an outcry that he's been excluded from the debate.
Well, there certainly has been from his supporters.
Yeah, no, I'm sure there has. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, in general, people might have said, I want to hear this other guy. I'm really not that happy with the two who are running. And we've heard that thousands of times during the campaign.
Okay. Well, Larry Sabato, thanks for your time today.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
About a year later, in October 2014, the UVA Center for Politics brought Louisiana State University political scientist Robert Mann to Charlottesville to discuss his book, Daisy Petals and Mushroom Clouds, which is about the use of advertising techniques in the 1964 presidential election, pitting Republican nominee Barry Goldwater against incumbent Democrat Lyndon Johnson. I asked him about the book and the significance of that year's campaign.
Let's talk about your book, Robert Mann. It's Daisy Petals and Mushroom Clouds. What's the thesis? What's the 30-second summary?
Well, the thesis is this presidential campaign that was a landslide victory, so it wasn't really a contest in the way that we normally think of political campaigns, but it was a campaign that changed politics, that changed the way politicians talk to voters, and that radically changed the way that the politicians advertise in their political spots and ads.
Do you think that change was inevitable, or was it something specific to the 64 race that had made the change happen?
I think it was inevitable. I think it would have happened eventually. I think someone would have figured out how to do it. It's just that these guys figured it out at a really interesting time, and it was the only time this ad firm had really ever. It's the first time they'd ever done political advertising. So it's interesting that a firm that had never done politics before ended up changing politics forever.
Let's talk a bit about the Daisy Girl ad, which was the topic of this conversation today.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about how that ad came about and what its impact was.
Well, the Johnson people began the campaign thinking they were going to talk about civil rights and, you know, the Great Society and all that, and they realized that the more potent issue was the fear that Americans still had about whether we would be embroiled in a nuclear war. The world was still very unsafe in a lot of ways. 2 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the nuclear test ban treaty had just been ratified, and Barry Goldwater had voted against it, and he had said a lot of reckless things about the use of nuclear weapons and the nuclear war, and there was a lot of fear in the American psyche, and Johnson and this ad firm recognized that, and they knew they needed to do something with it, that was their most powerful issue. So they built a big part, not the entire campaign, but they built a big part of their advertising campaign around exploiting that fear.
That Daisy Girl ad was only broadcast once by being paid for by
right.
the campaign,
right.
but it got a lot of replays on
mm-hmm.
the evening news.
Yes.
That's something of a strategy in today's politics.
It
where
is.
Campaigns
is.
Will put up an ad on YouTube in the hopes that the news media will pick it up and they never have to pay for it. Was
right.
that an intention?
I don't believe that they thought that would be the result of it. I think they were hoping that Goldwater and the Republicans would scream bloody murder, and that it would happen. But I think they thought that maybe Goldwater's people would be smart enough to handle it differently, and they weren't. So they were very happy when Goldwater protested and essentially completed part of the equation, which was they needed someone to say, yes, this is me. This spot was about me, because the spot didn't say, this is Barry Goldwater, he's going to blow up the world. They needed Barry Goldwater to say, hey, you just accused me of blowing up the world. So Goldwater was very helpful in doing that. But yeah, the spot was really the first instance of a spot that it probably got seen by more people on the news than it did when it actually aired as a paid advertisement.
That Johnson ad is very famous. People have seen it in mm-hmm. 50 years yeah. since. What was the tone of the Goldwater advertising campaign? How was it different from Johnson?
Well, Goldwater's campaigns, ads were his spots were primarily about the how society was breaking down and that the crumbling of American society, patriotism, and sex and pornography, and that society was just falling apart. Also, it's instructive to remember that Johnson was advertising almost exclusively with spots, 30-second, 60-second, 20-second spots. Goldwater ran a few spots, but primarily what Goldwater was doing was preempting 30-second television shows. And giving long speeches that no one wanted to watch. And Goldwater really didn't do that much spot advertising. He preempted television shows. In fact, the producers of Peyton Place on ABC credited Goldwater with driving an audience to them because several of Goldwater's 30-second speeches were opposite Peyton Place. So everybody was flipping, they didn't want to watch that, so they went over to find something entertaining, and they discovered Peyton Place.
The theme of the decline of American civilization seems to have failed Goldwater in 64, but it led to Nixon's success in 68. Would you agree with that?
And even more importantly, I think, is that it gave birth to Ronald Reagan. The movement, the conservative movement that Goldwater gave birth to in the early 1960s and culminating in 64, was picked up by Ronald Reagan, who, by the way, gave a nationally televised speech, A Time for Choosing, right before the election, and made a much more effective case for Goldwater's candidacy than Goldwater ever did.
George Will likes to say that Barry Goldwater won the 1964 election. It just took 16 years to count the vote.
Exactly. Yeah.
What else can you tell us about the content of your book? I mean, obviously, it talks about the campaign and the advertising. Does it go deeply into the inner workings of advertising agencies?
It does. So I spend a whole chapter talking about this advertising firm, Doyle Dane Birnbach, that created these spots and why they were the perfect ad firm to do it, but also explaining sort of the revolution that was going on in advertising at that time and how that up to that point, political campaigns had not discovered it. It was like there were these two versions of advertising. It was product advertising. It was roaring into the modern era, modern television era. And then there was television advertising for politicians. It was stuck, at the birth of television. The spots that Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon and John Kennedy ran in 1960 and 1964 looked very similar to the stuff that Eisenhower and Stevenson were running in 1952. They were stuck in time. And this ad firm, this revolutionary ad firm, DDB, brought these creative advertising principles that they were applying to sell all kinds of products. They brought it to politics and in the process revolutionized political advertising. But I have to sort of explain, why it was so significant that this firm and not some other firm got that account.
Well, thanks for your comments today. I appreciate it, and I look forward to reading the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As the holidays approach, a lot of us are thinking about home entertaining and the kinds of food and drink we can serve to party guests. At the 2014 Virginia Festival of the Book, I talked to author Philip Green about the favorite cocktail recipes of novelist Ernest Hemingway, who drank his way from Paris to Havana via the Spanish Civil War.
What sparked your interest in this topic that eventually got you to write a book about it?
Well, a couple of different things. One, I've been a Hemingway fan since high school, and I always noticed how Hemingway would put food and drink into his novels and short stories as a way of adding depth to the character, to the scene, to the atmosphere, to tell you something about what the characters were like, where they were, if they were in Italy or Spain or France or Cuba or Key West. But I'm also a history buff, and being a history buff and liking food and drink and having lived in New Orleans, I went to law school there, and I was always fascinated by the backstory of the great dishes. The Oysters Rockefeller was invented at Antoine's, and the Sazerac was invented here, and the Ramos Gin Fizz, and all the great stories. So you take sort of an interest and expertise in the historical side, an interest in knowledge of Hemingway and his life and times, and categorizing or cataloging the drinks of Hemingway and then putting all those sort of skill sets together, because I know there are a lot of people like me who read about the Jack Rose or read about the different Hemingway drinks in his short stories, and you think, how do you make that? Wouldn't I like to drink that while I'm reading this? And it, maybe it would make the experience more compelling. And that's sort of what hooked me from the beginning, was a drink that he mentioned in Islands in the Stream. I happened to be on vacation down in Florida, and there's a drink made with coconut water, lime juice, gin, and bitters. And my future in-law's house had a coconut tree with coconuts ready to fall, and they had a lime tree, and I made the drink. And I thought, how cool is this? I'm reading about this drink while I'm sipping it. So that sort of started this desire on my part to sort of catalog all of the drinks of not just Hemingway, but also, you know, Ian Fleming. What's James Bond drinking? Fleming did the same thing. He would tell you exactly what Bond was having for breakfast or having for dinner, because it just made the story that much more interesting. You could describe the room. Why not describe what they're eating and drinking?
Now, your book has, I think, 55 different recipes.
Correct.
How did you find all those recipes? Some of them were probably fairly obscure.
Some of them were easy. You just read Hemingway. You know, you read his novels, short stories, and you just dog-ear the pages and keep records that way. But I'm sure there's some I haven't found yet. In fact, I've found a few since I wrote the book. You look in his letters. You look in his biographies. You look in the fishing logbook from his boat Pilar or his friend Joe Russell's boat, the Anita. Wherever he wrote letters constantly, and so you're going to find a lot of great material where he's writing to his friend, this is how I make the Bloody Mary, or this is how I make my martini. And you also interview the children of his old friends, and they have, you know, they were offering me handwritten recipes that they used to have from back in the day in Key West, for example. My friend Dink Bruce, his father was Toby Bruce, one of Hemingway's best friends. They had some handwritten recipes from when they used to hang out with the Hemingways. So, you look at the obvious places, and then you never know what you're going to find when you scratch the surface. So.
Did you make each of the recipes yourself to taste the drinks?
Most of them. There's one drink called the El Definitivo that Hemingway created to try to impair he had a little baseball league in Cuba. So he had children running the base paths, and the grown-ups would hit. So there were grown-ups on both teams. And the grown-ups on the other team, he wanted to make sure his team had an edge, so he wanted to get them impaired, and he made this abominable cocktail called the El Definitivo, which was just about anything in the pantry all added together, you know, tequila, rum, gin, whiskey, you know, you name it, it was in there. And I didn't try that one, because I had a pretty good idea that it wouldn't taste very good. But most of the drinks I did try, and I can honestly say that he sort of opened my eyes to what a lovely drink vermouth is, even though he sort of scorned it in great quantity in his martini. There were several of his drinks that had a lot of vermouth, and vermouth is a lovely, lovely aromatized or fortified wine. Also Campari, the great aperitif bitter, that's in a number of his drinks. And I probably wouldn't have liked it without having been introduced to it by Hemingway, because it's an acquired taste.
There's something of a vermouth revival going on right now.
Definitely, definitely, yes.
Now, the book is mostly about cocktails. What was Hemingway's attitude towards beer and wine?
That's actually an idea of mine to do a sequel on the wine side, but he loved to drink beer. He did an advertisement for Ballantine beer. He had quite a palate for wine. You know, living in France and traveling to Spain and Italy, he had a great palate for wine, and you can see probably 100 references in his prose and letters to various wines. So it wasn't just limited to spirits.
My last question is just, as you were doing your research for this book, what was the one thing that you discovered that totally surprised you, that you just did not expect to come across?
I guess the degree to which he did separate drinking from writing. I mean, I suspected it, but I didn't realize how strongly it would be confirmed that he had his discipline, his, you know, self-restraint. He would not drink for the most part when he was writing. He did early in his career, and he admits to it in A Movable Feast. When he was in Paris, he's probably 23 years old, in a cafe, sipping some rum while he writes about some boys up in Michigan. But for the most part, he saw himself like a boxer in training. You know, he would have to do the work, and relax later. So he would write every morning, and then he would drink in the afternoons and evenings as a way of replenishing the well, because drinking took so much out of him. He felt like a wrung out dish rag, and that was a way of sort of changing his ideas, letting his subconscious work on the story while he was enjoying the drinking and sleeping, and then he'd wake up the next morning and the well would be refilled, and he would pick up the story again and continue to create.
That's it for this week's episode of The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to come back next week for more news, reviews, and interviews. And don't forget to tell your friends where to find us.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.